shots. Mangiapane gets away. Dubé's all alone. Stop, rebound, stop, two. Third chance off the outside of the post. They score. Fourth opportunity, and Mangiapane puts it in for the shorthanded goal that makes it 3-0 Calgary.
He's a story, and going to spend the next little while here talking about the Calgary Flames in action tonight against the Chicago Blackhawks. Looking forward to that one. One of only three on the board this evening. By the way, great call again from Rick Ball there. Haley Salvian joins us from The Athletic. Hello, Haley.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. You want to hear something?
Sure.
Okay, this is how to pronounce Andrew Mangiapane's name correctly as pronounced by my Italian producer. Y'all sit there, Matt Marchese. Hop your, get your mic hot.
I'm ready to
show,
go.
Show Haley how you pronounce Andrew Mangiapane's name correctly.
Mangiapane.
Okay. Yeah.
I may have to defer to Maddie in subsequent parts of this interview. When we talk about this guy who's got 15 goals, Haley, 15 goals. Now, we won't talk about the assists, but whatever. Goals are expensive. Goals are hard to come by. What do you make of the 15 goals? We'll start there.
Yeah, well, I think Mangiapane is shooting at a 31% rate right now, so he's getting a ton of help. He's getting a ton of puck luck. Obviously, it's great. I mean, he's leading the Flames in scoring. I didn't check the updated scores, but the other day when I wrote my story about it, I think only Leon Draisaitl had more goals than Mangiapane, and he has the most 5-on-5 goals in the league right now. So It's a really impressive start for a player that I think really everyone expected to have a kind of breakout season. I think everyone saw him play at the World Championships, and that was a big, not everyone, excuse me, but a lot of people saw him play at the World Championships, and everyone started maybe paying a bit more attention to someone who everyone in this market had already really liked and seen a lot from. But, you know, I think this is what a lot of people probably expected from a guy who all he's ever done is, like, work really hard, get better, progress positively in his game. And I think the Flames were expecting a big season from him.
Right.
And we're seeing that. Like I said, he's being helped out by a ton of puck luck. Again, you're not going to go 82 games scoring one goal in every three shots. And if he is, he's, you know, going to win. I mean, Draisaitl's on that pace too right now. But, like, I mean, whatever.
I
if that happens, I will hand out the Rocket Richard if he scores 65 goals this year. I volunteer for the league to do that. But one of the good things about Andrew's goals is you look at where all the shot attempts are coming from, and they're right in front of the crease. They're in high danger areas. He's got a real nose for the net, and he has an improved shot. I mean, he has a good shot. So you're just getting it's a lot of good, sustainable stuff from Andrew, except for the shooting percentage. That will come down to earth. But once that does, the Flames are going to have a really good two-way, reliable player who everyone in this market has really loved for a long time.
And he's a great story too, right? Like you love the story of the undrafted junior player, you know, who was and his family too, you know, shocked that he could, you know, catch on with the very coolest of the OHL. He was going to US college. They thought that was the route he was going to end up, a late round pick of the Calgary Flames. He pops. Like, he's the guy that, you know, what's the old saying? You know, smaller hockey players have to prove they can play, and big hockey players have to prove that they can't. Like, it's still, in a lot of ways, as much as the door is more open now for smaller players, it's still kind of true that they really have to prove that they can play. And listen, Mangiapane's proven that this guy can play, and it's a story that's relatable, Haley, I guess, to all sports fans, no matter what sport you follow.
Yeah, he is a great story, and I spoke to him at the beginning of the season. I did a piece just on exactly what you were talking about, Jeff, just this really impressive rise of this player who, for all intents and like, he shouldn't be here right now based on the trajectory he was on when he was younger. All he'd ever been told was, Andrew, you're a good player, but you're not big enough. Get an education. Go play in the NCAA. Let hockey get you a college education. Get the full ride scholarship. You're a good NCAA player, but that's all you're ever going to be. May as well use hockey to, you know, go and get that full ride scholarship. And I think that, you know, I was talking to Andrew, and it was funny because, you know, he was studying for his SATs when the Barrie Colts first reached out to him. And He was joking. He's like, the studies weren't going great. So, like, I'm kind of glad that they did, because he's studying for his SATs. And he's like, oh, man, And I took my SATs. It's not an easy test, so we kind of had a laugh over how brutal that is. But that's how far along in that path he had gone, right? He was fully prepared and ready to try to ace that test, get a good score, go to a good college, get a good education. That was probably 8-9 years ago, and now he's, you know, leading the Flames in scoring. He's one of the top scorers in the NHL right now. So it's a really impressive rise for a player who, like I said, I mean, all he's really ever done is year over year get better and blow past expectations, and that's because he has this really relentless drive and work ethic. I think he's listed at 5'9". He's 5'9", 5'10". But he doesn't play like that, and it sounds so cliche, but it's true. Like, he will go into the corner against a guy who's 6'3", who has 40 pounds on him, and that's what's really endeared himself to the fans, to the coaches he's always had. He doesn't care that he's the smallest guy on the ice, and like you said, too, he's proving that he can do this, even though he, you know, the tape measure doesn't go quite as high as some other players. But, you know, it's an impressive rise for, again, a player who, I mean, he's a guy who probably, if he didn't believe in himself and he didn't get that call from the Colts, or, you know, he didn't, you know, keep on trying, he wouldn't be here right now. And, it's, you know, I'm always so enamored with players who have stories like that. It's just a good human story. He told me his mom yelled at Dale Hawerchuk in the parking lot of the Barrie Colts Arena when they were trying to sign him. She's like, no, my son has a full ride scholarship. You're trying to take that away. If you are not serious about my son playing in the Ontario Hockey League, like, don't mess with us. And it was just so funny. He's like, yeah, my mom was yelling at Dale. And, oh, my God. It's a great family story. It's just funny. I wrote about it at the beginning of the season. It was probably my favorite story of the season so far.
It's so good. Yeah. You know, Hall of Famer, 1,500 points. Yeah. No big deal. Mom's just screaming at him in the parking lot. Love it. Okay. So,
parents, right? They just care. They just cared about Andrew's future, right? And they'd been told the same thing. So I'm sure it was pretty jarring for the family to hear for the first time, too.
So we're asking the question about, you know, the goals, and is it real? Is it sustainable? Is it fool's gold? What about the team itself? And we'll get to the shutouts here in a couple of moments. But is this, I mean, based on expectations going into the season, because we kind of looked at this and said, oof, I don't know. I don't know about the Flames this season. But listen, it's a team that's tops of a division that's a lot better than we thought it was going to be at the beginning of the season. Are the Flames real or are they fool's gold? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think if you looked at the Flames at the beginning of the season, a lot of people were like, they're probably good enough to make it into the playoffs because the Pacific's not good enough. But are they good enough to do something once they get there? And I think, you know, the latter part of that question, are they good enough to do something in the playoffs, is still a big question mark, because they, quite frankly, this a very similar group to what they have now hasn't got it done in the playoffs. And I think there's a lot of fans who will start believing once they see it in the postseason. But as of right now, I think we haven't really seen much from this Calgary Flames team to really start doubting. I did a story the other day on reasons to believe that they're contenders and reasons to doubt, and it was difficult to find real reasons for concern that didn't just seem nitpicky. Yes, they've lost 5 games in overtime. I went back and watched all those overtime losses, and a couple of them were just turnovers that turned into 2-on-1s, and that, you know, OT is a possession game and anything can happen. You make one mistake and, you know, Jamie Benn's got a 2-on-1 and they score and win. So, and obviously we know there's no 3-on-3 overtime in the playoffs. So, you know, that's something that I think some fans are concerned of. I don't know if that's a really a big deal. Obviously, if you're losing, you know, double digits in overtime and leaving that many points on the board, you can start to question it. But to me, I think there's been more positives out of this group than negatives. I mean, they've lost 3 games in regulation, so it's hard to really start getting, you know, angry. But I think their 5-on-5 numbers are really strong. As of the other day, they had the best expected goals rate in the league, which means they're controlling the quality of shots more than their opponents, and the best rate in the league, which is always an important thing. And that's the credit to Daryl Sutter Hockey, right? His teams like to have possession of the puck. They like to get the most shot share. They like to spend lots of time in the offensive zone. And those are all really strong and important things. It's hard to get scored on when the other team doesn't have the puck often. So their percentage of the shot share is impressive. And I think just the way that they've been playing is really good. And I think Daryl Sutter is one of the big reasons to be optimistic at just what he's done with this group. I think I said this to you the first time I came on your show in the preseason, was we didn't see the changes externally that people wanted. We didn't see the sweeping change to the core. But the changes we were going to see with the Flames is what Daryl Sutter can do systematically, stylistically with this group, and the way he can maximize his players' output. And I think we're seeing that. And he's a real reason to be optimistic about the future of this team. It's still early, but I would sure. say that this is – I haven't found a reason to say, no, I don't think they're legit yet.
Listen, we're at the quarter mark, right? I mean, there were 19 games in for the Calgary Flames, so we're starting to see patterns and starting to see trends. And I think one of the things that a lot of people are surprised at and surprised by, so I'm not in the minority on this one. Sure, Oliver Shillington is a nice story. Sure, the top line has been fantastic. Sure, we just talked about Andrew Mangiapane and his 15 goals this season, but I'm just stunned, Haley, they can do all of this without Mark Giordano. Like, I know the goaltending has been outstanding, the systems, etc., but all of this without, a recent Norris Trophy winner, that to me is stunning. That is stunning, Haley.
Yeah, I was talking to someone yesterday, actually, and I just said, what would this team look like right now, later in the season and in the postseason with Mark Giordano on that top pair? Like, what does this blue line, what do the Calgary Flames look like with Mark Giordano still on this team? And they're doing it without him, but it's so hard to not think about what it would be like if he was here. I think that would be something that could, potentially tip them over the edge, because you see what he's doing in Seattle, and Seattle is, they look like an expansion team. And he's still one of the, he's one of the best, I think he is the best defender on that team, and him and Jamie Oleksiak have made one of the better pairs, at least analytically, in the league right now, even though some of the actual goals against might not add up to their defensive outputs because their goaltending's not great right now. But, yeah, it's impressive that they're doing this without their Norris Trophy winner, without their number one defenseman. I'm a big fan of Chris Tanev. I think it's no coincidence that two young players are having, really great seasons. I guess it would be three if you go back to Quinn Hughes. Like, that's all he really does is be solid defensively. He does everything right in his own zone, and he just uplifts the young players that are on his pair. So to me, you could fairly argue that Chris Tanev's the number one defenseman on the Calgary Flames, but Mark Giordano absolutely would have been if he was still here. And I thought the blue line was going to be a work in progress all season, and I think that's been one of the biggest pleasant surprises on this team. Eric and Branson's been pretty good, and I think he was a really highly criticized signing, but the Flames are using him well, and he's playing his role well, and the third pair has switched a lot with Valimaki and Zadorov, but whoever's been in has been fine. And but again, you kind of think, look at the blue line depth with Mark Giordano on this team, and how much better could they be.
It's true. One of the things that we're all sort of wondering about, too, when you talk about, shooting percentages of 31% being unsustainable, that's true. What about 7 shutouts in 11 games, 11 wins, rather? Is that sustainable, Haley Salvian?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't want to be the one to say it and then they go and break a bunch of records, But it's fun. Like, it's impressive what they're doing right now, and it's a credit to Vladar and Markstrom. I've said this to other people. Vladar is like on, and this has nothing to do with shutouts, but he's on like Jack Campbell level niceness. Like, if he had more airtime or something on, if he had the same airtime that Jack Campbell has in interviews, I think people would love him just the same. Like, this is a really good young player. He's waited a long time for this moment, and I think, like, Vladar hasn't lost a game in regulation yet. He has 2 shutouts back-to-back. Right now, of goalies who've started at least 5 games, he's top in the league. And save percentage and goals against average, it's a great start for a young player who all he wanted to do was prove that he's an NHL goalie, and we're seeing that so far. And Jacob Markstrom, it's not a leap to see him playing this well. He did it in Vancouver with a team that was struggling defensively, and now he's doing it behind a team who's playing a lot better and with a lot more structure with Daryl Sutter. And so I don't know if they're going to get 7 shutouts every 19 games or every 11 wins. I don't know if we can safely assume that, because it's, maybe. But I will say the two of the last goalies to get double-digit shutouts was Mika Kiprasov and Jonathan Quick, and those were both on Daryl Sutter coach teams. And it's, you know, historically, I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury was the most recent goaltender to have at least 10 shutouts in a season. But just looking back through the Flames lens, two of the more recent ones in Kiprasov and Quick were both coached by Daryl Sutter at the time. And historically, we know that Daryl Sutter coached teams don't give up a lot. Like we just talked about it, they don't give up a ton of shots against. And when they do give up shots against, not a lot of them are high danger chances. So it's a lot better environment for goaltenders to be in. They still have to make the saves, but they don't really need to steal games the same way. I think last year at the beginning of the season, a lot, Markstrom was kind of the Band-Aid covering up the issues in front of him in Calgary. He doesn't need to be that now because they're playing so much better in front of him. And that's a good environment for shutouts. So, you know, seven every 11 wins, it's a lot. But I think the environment is really good. And if the goalies can keep staying sharp and being technically and positionally sound and playing the way that they are, it's not unheard of to think that they're going to keep putting up impressive numbers.
And it was Sutter who robbed the San Jose Sharks of Mika Kiprasov, knowing full well what he was capable of when he was with San Jose himself. I think it was a second round pick, I think. They got their franchise goalie away from San Jose for. Anyhow, look forward to this one tonight. Calgary Flames and Chicago Blackhawks. Haley Salvian has been my guest from The Athletic. Haley, thank you. You are released now for the rest of the day. Thanks, as always, for stopping by, Haley. You're one of the best. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. There she is, Haley Salvian from The Athletic. Tonight, the Calgary Flames face off against the Chicago Blackhawks. Watch this one on Sportsnet 1. Hawks are coming off a 1-0 win. As much as you can call it a win. Like, it's a win, but, like, that's a game won by the goaltender. Marc-Andre Fleury was just outstanding. They took those 2 points and ran. Chicago, we know about Chicago off the ice, and that is always the bigger story. Chicago on the ice is certainly a story as well. We saw the new coach bump with Derek King coming in, but now people are starting to wonder if it's more akin to a dead cat bounce. We'll see what the Hawks can do now, and they have some decisions on the horizon. And you will look at, you know, a player like Jonathan Toews, who we all know, you know, didn't play last season, suffering the effects of COVID. To start this season, Toews has been underwhelming by his or any other standard. 18 games, 0 goals, 8 points for Jonathan Toews. It's tough. I'll tell you who's carrying it, though. Who's lugging it? And you just, like, Pat Kane is just like an automatic. But Alex DeBrincat is having a real nice season for the Chicago Blackhawks. 11 goals, 14 points in 18 games. DeBrincat's playing great. One of 3 games on the board this evening. When we come back, hour 2, that's coming up here in a couple of moments. We'll talk to Bruce Boudreau. We'll talk to Leah Hextall. But up next on the Montreal page with Eric Engels. Keep it here.
Has to come out, fires it off the glass, but not out. Here's an opportunity for Anderson. Anderson waits to the side, and they score. Dvorak, what a pass by Anderson, patient to find Dvorak.
Good to hear Faldsy on the call. Rob Falds with the call of that one is heard on Hockey Night in Canada. Welcome to hour 2 of the Jeff Merrick Show. Glad to be along with you. Bottom of the hour, Leah Hextall, Bruce Boudreau coming up in about 20 minutes' time. In the meantime, we'll turn our attention to the Montreal Canadiens and that market with our good friend Eric Engels, who covers the team for Sportsnet.ca. Eric, how are you, bud?
I'm doing good, Jeff. You?
I'm good. How is everything in... I have a lot of family that lives in Montreal. How is everything in one of my favorite Canadian cities?
You know what? It's not bad. I think we're into these, I guess, milder beginning of winter kind of phases. Like last year, I remember playing golf on November 17th, and it hasn't snowed yet, and we're deep into November. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed that it continues that way.
Love Montreal. Old Montreal, the cobblestone. I've always said to people, Eric, and you've had this experience countless times, Every single hockey fan needs to have the Saturday Montreal hockey experience. You know, go to cafes in old Montreal, walk down the cobblestone streets, all the places they're all talking about the game that night. And then, you know, getting to the rink and, you know, 7:01 and Fix You is back and the lights go dark and Fix You hits and the Ghost of the Forum and all of it all come back all at once. Like, the Montreal hockey experience, specifically on a Saturday, Eric, is unlike any other experience in the NHL, true or false?
Oh, true. And it's unique to each individual, right? I mean, growing up here, I had my own routine going to the game, usually involved going to Mr. Steer with the family, which is a little burger joint by the Bell Center. And Montreal is such a small town that invariably you would walk by the same bums. You know what I mean? Like, on the way to the rink, like, it was part of the tradition that you'd see the one-armed guy with no shirt on in freezing cold before hitting the rink, and you get warm up and that music comes on, and it's just such a special experience. For somebody else, it might be a smoked meat sandwich, you know, at Schwartz's in Maine or whatever it is, or like you said, old Montreal, where there's a lot of good places to eat and walk around and see something cool, or walk up on the mountain and check out the lookout. This city is an awesome city. I'm proud to be born and raised here, and I love to eat in this town and love to go see the game, so happy to make a living doing it.
You know, I was recently having a conversation with Colby Armstrong, former Montreal Canadian, and I was asking about his experiences playing with the Habs, and he said one of his biggest thrills is, you know, he was just walking down the street one day, and Mr. Béliveau was holding court at a restaurant having breakfast, and he sort of motions over to Colby, who was just walking down the street, and said, Colby, come in. And he motioned over to Colby, and Colby's like, oh my God, it's Sean Béliveau. He's calling me in to come sit at the table and sit and talk hockey with his circle of friends. And he said he couldn't wait to call his wife afterwards. So, like, it was one of the great hockey experiences of his life. Do you have many from your youth brushes with Montreal Canadiens fame as a kid?
I have a tremendous Sean Béliveau story, actually.
Do it. Oh, I love these.
I feel like I was somewhere around like 15 years old or something like that. We were in Florida for a family vacation, which was rare. My parents, you know, sacrificed a lot. We didn't take a lot of vacations, but they, you know, they sacrificed to send us to school and camp and all those things. But it was one of the first vacations we took as a family. Went down to Florida, and it might have been spring break and around Super Bowl weekend or whatever it was, and the Canadians were playing back-to-back home games, matinee games, and that's always the case around that time of year. Mm-hmm. And we're in the airport at Fort Lauderdale on our way home to Montreal, and I'm standing in the security line with my two brothers with all our stuff for having been on vacation for a week or whatever it is, and Sean Béliveau is within eyesight. My older brother tugs on my arm and says, Eric, that's Sean Béliveau over there. And we, like, drop all of our stuff and walk over to him and say, hey, you know, it's an honor and a pleasure to meet you. And he's so gracious and so kind, spends time talking and asking us about ourselves and all that. And at the end of the conversation, I don't know why, I just turned to him and said, hey, like, do you know who the Canadians are playing today? They're supposed to be playing this afternoon. And by the way, he was stuck in the airport for like 17 hours and delayed. Ooh. And wasn't on our flight. And anyways, so he goes, oh, you know what? I'm not sure. I usually keep a pocket schedule on me. I can't remember who they're playing, whatever it is. Fine. We let him go. It's like the greatest thrill of our lifetime. We just met Sean Béliveau, our father's hero, this and that. We go through security. We walk through the gate. And like 45 minutes later, we're sitting at our gate waiting for our plane to travel. And my older brother elbows me and he says, Sean Béliveau's running towards us right now. And I'm like, what? I look up and he is like in a jog running towards us. And he goes, guys, I just wanted to let you know they're playing Atlanta. It was like, and you know, over the years, I'm going to the Bell Center for years, 15 years, I've been walking into the Bell Center and doing this job. You know, I'd walk in often at the same time at security with him and had a couple of great interactions with him. But you'd always see there would be people who would look at him and recognize who he was, and he wouldn't wait for them to come up to him. He would go up to them, you know, to break the ice and make them feel comfortable. That was just the kind of person he was. The other Sean Béliveau story I have is that there was a game at the Bell Center for the playoffs where the Canadians were – It was 2010, their crazy run, and he had a moment in the tunnel with Glenn Metropolit. I think that was captured on camera. And right before that, I just happened to be in the bathroom next to him. And he just turns to me and said, I think they're going to win tonight. And then he walked out and went and had that moment with Dan Metropolitan, which inevitably was later known that he told him, like, go get this done or something like that. And anyways, yeah. It was just amazing being able to be in his company and be around him. And he was just so welcoming and gracious with everyone.
He's the best. I could listen to John Béliveau's stories all day. I was saying this on the show last week. One of my greatest solos was when I was doing ringside with Hockey Night, one of my first ones. And, you know, John Béliveau walks down, you know, outside after the first intermission. I'm set up in the hallway through an interview with, like, I don't know, Andre Markov or something. He just says, "Salut, Jeff." And I'm like, how does John Béliveau know mine? I guess in that deep basso profundo voice of his. Anyway, getting off track to start the interview, I could hear Béliveau stories all day.
Good track. Good track, though. And his wife, too, by the way, Elise Béliveau, like the nicest person on earth. So
100%. Just beautiful people. Montreal Canadiens. So Sportsnet.ca, this one must have been both an easy one and a challenging one at the same time. Where do you see the Habs now, a quarter of the way into the season, Eric Engels?
Well, first of all, my editor, Rory Boylan, he's been, you know, for the last like 3 weeks being like, when are we going to write the Shane Wright piece? You know, I'm just like, I'm waiting for that. I know we have to do that quarter mark report, so I'm waiting for this to get to 20 games so that we just look, you know. I had an interview with Mark Bergevin on the weekend. I didn't expect him to say that, oh yeah, we're going full board into the tank. But the way I put it to him was very simple. You didn't choose to be in this position, but you're in this position. And the reason why the Canadians need to try to take advantage of it is because while there are no guarantees that you can draft first overall, even if you crater out and finish at the bottom of the standings, the probabilities are greater that they can actually do that than make the playoffs this year or contend for the Stanley Cup. And the way I see it is it could be a blessing in disguise for them because they'd never hope to have a season like this, especially in the midst of a pandemic with the business being what it is, attendance down, the revenue not being what anybody wants it to be, regardless of where the team is at. If they were, you know, breaking down the doors in that first place in the league, I think it would still be difficult for them to redeem what they've lost throughout the pandemic. And it's not just them, it's across the league. And it's going to take a few years to rebound, and everybody knows that. But you look at their salary cap situation, Jeff, like what would you do? You know, they've got, including Shea Weber's long-term IR designation, $84 million committed to 14 players next year. They've got six forwards signed through 2025. And I don't even think they want to tear. I don't think they need to tear it down. They've got a lot of good players on this roster moving forward that they can build around. But the only way to get better in the positions of need that they really have are through the draft. And, you know, center took a big hit with Philip Deneau walking out, and is Barry Kotkaniemi getting offer sheeted? And I think people need to give Christian Dvorak a bit of slack and give him an opportunity to grow with the team and find his way when nobody has played well. And he's certainly been better over the last few games. On defense, you lose Shea Weber and Joel Edmondson's been out since the start of the year. That's a huge gap to make up and change. And I just think, you know, if they can find a way to creatively sell the youth movement and the prospects and give them opportunities and turn to whatever guys that are injured or in need of surgery and say, hey, you know, like, now's the time. Like, go get it. You've been putting off a hip surgery for 2 years. Now's the time. Go do it. If you're hurt, you know, let's take a step back and come back when you're 100%. And they're never going to try to lose the games right now. They don't have to try. They're losing the majority of them. But, you know, if they can give themselves the best possible opportunity to draft high and potentially even draft Shane Wright in Montreal, that would solve a lot of problems for them with a roster that should be good moving forward with the players they have signed.
And especially considering they're hosting the draft as well to become the stars of it would be something else. Yeah, the thing that I wonder about, you know, if they're going to, you know, look at the situation that they're in and say, okay, you know what, it's time maybe we take a couple of steps backwards to push ourselves forwards. There's some players that I wonder about. Like, even if it's going to be it's so many cliche, the mini rebuild, the competitive rebuild, the whatever rebuild, you know, there's some players that are, 29 years old, for example, Tyler Toffoli, Brendan Gallagher, if this is the direction that the team is going to go in, and we all know that it's going to be built around, you know, Nick Suzuki, and it's going to be built around Cole Caulfield, and it's going to be built around, you know, these types of players in this age group, you know, if you're one of the older guys, do you want to stick around for this? Like, if you're Gallagher, if you're Toffoli, do you want to hang around for this if this is going to be the, you know, the plan for the next 3 years? What do you think?
I don't think it is a three-year plan, really. I think it's more of a one-year crater out and get as many good draft picks as possible. And there's some prospects that are maturing, and there's a lot of good players that are already signed. In Toffoli's case, you know, you're looking at a player at a very decent cap hit, only under contract for another couple of years after this one, that I think would garner a lot of interest. In Gallagher's case, he's in year one of a deal that pays him $6.5 million for a number of years moving forward. I don't, as much as I know that Brendan Gallagher is a glue guy, a heart and soul guy, and this and that, you're selling him at a complete loss if you go into the market looking to trade him at this point. So I don't necessarily see that happening. But I look at guys like Toffoli. I look at potentially Jonathan Drouin, who's 1 year left and is playing pretty good hockey here. I think he's played really well, actually, to be honest with you. He missed six games after getting hit in the head with that shot from Brett Kulak, but he started off the season great. He's played with great energy. He was excellent in their last game, which was actually a win, their fifth one of the season. You know, that's a player that I think could prove attractive with only 1 year left on his deal. You know, Ben Chiarot, if I was the Toronto Maple Leafs, the number one player I would want to add is Ben Chiarot, who's a pending unrestricted free agent. And as much as you'd like to sign him and keep him as a part of the defense, they've got Jeff Petrie under contract long-term. They've got Joel Edmondson under contract long-term and David Savard under contract long-term. And inevitably, you have to make some room for some of the younger guys that are coming. Maybe if you can convince Jordan Harris to, if even though he's an unrestricted free agent at the end of his year at Northeastern as a senior there, he's their draft pick, and maybe they'll be able to convince him to stay. Caden Gooley's on his way. You know, there's Matthias Norlander is in Montreal right now. He'll probably go back to Sweden, but this taste of experience might get him closer to the NHL. I think Ben Chiarot is a guy that, regardless of what they do with the other guys with some of the term, he's going to be attractive to some teams out there. And if I was Toronto and I'm looking at, you know, what the biggest need is, you've got Jake Muzzin, and if you can get a guy that's similar to him, I see the value in that kind of player. Brett Kulak is another, inevitably Chris Wyman, whatever. You'll look at the free agents. Arturi Lehkonen is the guy who does everything right but put the puck in the net. But a lot of teams love what he brings. So there's ways to collect some assets and just make this a one-year kind of deal and do the best you can with that.
You know, the one team that's out there that has Stanley Cup aspirations and we believe has everything on the table, whether it's prospects, whether it's first-round picks, who could be a trade partner for Montreal with someone like Ben Chiarot specifically, is Ken Holland and Edmondson. Like right now, the way they have McDavid playing, the way they have Dreisaitl playing, the way they have, there's a number of players, those are just the two obvious ones. They're looking for help on the left side of their blue line. That one would make a lot of sense to me. Like, I understand from the player personnel, I just don't know that Toronto wants to be in the business of letting go of more first-round draft picks, to say nothing of prospects at the same time. Edmonton has both, and I believe is willing to let go of both, figuring this is a huge opportunity for them right now. That one would make some sense to me. What about you?
Yeah, it makes sense to me for sure. You know, I think of Edmonton and what they're putting up right now and the way they're playing, it's certainly making a move like that would go a long way towards bolstering a blue line that's already improved significantly. They lost Ethan Bear, which is a bit of toughness, and they did it for a good reason, to get a pretty good player in Warren Fogley. But I think, you know, if you have those type of asks, if you're any team out there and you're looking to make a playoff run and you watch what Ben Chiarot did in the last 2 years in the playoffs, you should recognize what the value is there. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this, Jeff. I had the value of being in the rink, in the bubble, you know, and there's certain things that you just see when you're there live that you can't see on TV. And it's really important to watch a guy like Ben Chiarot away from the cameras, because the physical punishment that this guy doles out on a shift-by-shift basis away from the puck is something that he's just old school. There's an intimidation factor in his game that's very rare and very hard to come by. I still think if I was a team like Toronto, I would go down that road. I think Toronto wants to win this year. I think that's what it's all about for them, and I wouldn't hesitate for a second. You know, when you hear a guy like Tyler Toffoli say, as soon as Jake Muzzin went down in game six, we knew we were going to win the series. You know, you'd like to at least have some sort of insurance for that policy. Mm-hmm. I just think I agree with you. Edmonton's a great call, but if you're any team out there and you think you have a legit chance of winning, adding a 6'3", 230-pound guy who plays like that and also is an excellent skater, I would be very interested in that guy. I think it'll hurt the Montreal Canadiens to lose him, but that's the reality of the business and where the financials are at.
Let me finish up by asking you about the owner here. Should we or do you read anything into the fact that we have not heard from Jeff Molson?
I think it's weak. I think it's definitely weak. You know, he's put his GM in a terribly compromised position. It's strange. You know, he backed him in 2018 when a lot of us, myself included, thought, you know, Mark Bergevin had done a year and a half of work following 5 years of really good work that was quite poor, and that there was legitimate reason to make a change then, and he backed him then. And then, you know, I think Mark Bergevin did tremendous work last year that probably should have resulted in him winning the Jim Gregory Award. I know he got the most first place votes for the award and ended up losing to Lou Lamoriello, and the team goes to the Stanley Cup final. And I don't care what everybody else in the hockey world says about this, because I'm hearing a lot of people saying, oh, well, this year is just proving that was a complete fluke and this and that. Like, that just tells me you didn't watch the Canadiens play in the playoffs. You know, they had 13 games in the middle of it where they literally played perfect hockey. They didn't allow a power play goal for, I don't know what it was, 40 chances in a row. It wasn't just Carey Price and Shea Wett. Like, everyone was playing tremendous from about game five of the Toronto series through to the Stanley Cup final. So they deserve to be where they were. And Mark Bergevin built the team saying, you know, I think we're built for the playoffs, and that proved to be right. And it was odd to me that, you know, Jeff Molson would spend $110 million on the roster or over $100 million on the roster, but not be willing to pay market value for what the GM was asking for and what he believes he's worth after 10 years on the job. That put them in a strange position. Everything that's happened since has been a disaster, and he's been, you know, parked away from it. But, you know, more important than saying anything about it, if he's not going to come out and say anything, he better be doing his planning behind the scenes and be ready for something to sell to the fan base, because they're going to be pretty furious with the way this whole thing has gone. And if it comes to be that, you know, Mark Bergevin handles the trade deadline and then for whatever reason isn't able to have his contract just expire and walks out after June 30th, and they don't have the next guy in place and they've already gone through the draft, it's not a good way of conducting your business. So if Jeff Molson is simply biding his time, that's one thing. If he's spending his time creating a transition plan, because it seems pretty clear to me that I don't expect Mark Bergevin to be back here next year, he better have a good way of selling it when he comes out and speaks inevitably.
What's the marketplace doing right now? Where are Habs fans just sort of resigned to this is about the draft at this point? Where are Habs fans? We'll end on this one.
It's always the hardest question to answer because it's such a bipolar kind of fan base, right? Like, there's some people that want to see them win every single game. There's some people that want to see them lose every single game. There's some people that want complete carnage. There's some people that believe that the team is going to pull off a miracle from here to the end of the season. And that's kind of what makes this marketplace fun. You know, at the end of the day, I think the majority, we'll forget about the vocal minority for now. I think the majority has their head screwed on right about what they think needs to happen with this team and the direction it needs to go in, and that they know that there are good pieces in place and that the team could benefit from a situation that they didn't want to see the team in, but that's the situation they're in, and that's the one we started talking about, which is get the best draft pick available here and in every round, essentially, and hope that some young players graduate with the excitement level that a guy like Caulfield or Romanov brings to the ice, and they'll accept that. You know, the idea that they won't accept it in a town like Montreal is, I think we're way past those days. Mm-hmm. It's a question for ownership and PR and whoever else, the new GM or the current one, to sell it appropriately the way other teams have. They've said the precedent has been set for them by other teams. There's no reason they can't go down that road this way. And then people understand, and, you know, you hope the financials rebound to a certain degree. I think Canadiens fans will always buy merchandise and tickets to go watch the team.
I don't disagree. This has been great. You can check out Eric's work on the Montreal Canadiens at the quarter mark of the season, and also his piece on Marc Bergevin as well as Sportsnet.ca. Thanks, Eric. Always a pleasure, pal.
Thanks, Jeff. Take care.
There he is, Eric Engels from Sportsnet.ca. From Eric Engels, we dovetail to another one of our favorites. He is Bruce Boudreau, former NHL coach, works with the NHL Network as well, and has an opinion. It's one of the reasons I love having you on, Gabby, is you have an opinion about a lot of different things, and they're always unique. And I want to open with this one. And first of all, good afternoon. Thanks so much for doing this, Gabby.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well. It's good to talk to you. So about an hour ago, on Twitter, a Twitter feed that goes by the handle Hockey Samurai put out a number of one big collage of WHA logos, World Hockey Association logos, and it's just a simple little, you know, Twitter question, you know, which is the best WHA logo. To which I responded, Toronto Toros. I went to so many Toros games as a kid, fond memories, and Bassett's team, and, you know, John Garrett on the squad, and Vaslav Nedimansky, and Mihailovic, and all of it. From your point of view, not who was the best team, but which of those WHA logos, because they were great, which one, will open frivolous, which one was your favorite WHA logo, Gabby?
Well, as the Toro one was good, I certainly believe that the Minnesota Fighting Saints had the best logo. And not just because I played for them, but think about it. They got a halo over a little guy with a tooth missing. And so, like, I mean, it just looked so, it had so much symbolism in it. And I thought it was great. And, you know, I mean, the colors were sort of orange and white, and I just thought it sunk in so well, and to the point where on my junior team, I've got the same halo over it because it's Cubs, and Cubs are the same as like a little saint who's pretending to be a saint. I always think of them as, I really do think of them as Eddie Haskell's. You know, like on Leave It to Beaver, whereas, yes, Mr. Beaver, everything's okay, but you turn your back and boom, yeah, I'm coming after you. And I just, those things hit me right off the bat.
Well, you played on, now correct me if I'm wrong, you played on that Minnesota Fighting Saints that had Jack Carlson, who may have been the toughest of the bunch. Paul Holmgren, I think, would have been on that squad as well. And I'm going to throw a dart and say, was Kurt Brackenberry on that team too?
He was my roommate. Mm-hmm.
Oh, what was Kurt Brackenberry like as a roommate?
He was a really, really nice guy, but a little wild.
Well, hang on. That was a team with Billy Butters on it. So when you say wild, was he like Billy Butters crazy, or was he like a shade lower?
Well, at that time, nobody, and I mean nobody in professional sports, was crazier than Billy Butters. None.
Yep.
There wasn't anybody even close. And now Billy Butters is
man of the Lord.
He's man of the Lord, and he works for the Minnesota Wild. So, like, when I first went there to coach, his first thing was to write me a letter basically apologizing for what happened, you know, 40 years ago.
And are you serious?
Yeah. And he didn't know if I'd ever want to talk to him. And I said, I forgive and forget. And we met only in the last year of me being there. And we shook hands and said, yeah, I'm good. You know, everything's okay. But, and not going into detail of what was going on back in those days, but I mean, if you could imagine that he knew about this 40 years later. That's how crazy this team was. I mean, they had the Henry Bouchers and Ron Buzniaks, and every tough guy known to man went through that organization, from Ogie Oglethorpe to Gordy Gallant and
Machine Gun.
Yeah. Yeah, and we had them all. I mean, it was a crazy time, but there's a lot of laughs involved in that too.
Was that okay? I'm gonna throw another dart here. Was that the team that had the brawl with New England where Carlson ended up fighting Nick Fatiu in the penalty box?
Yep, and that was a crazy one too. Like, I mean, there was no stopping. there was one that was funny is when we were in San Diego, we had a bench clearing brawl. It seemed like it happened every second game. And we won the game 3-2 or something. And I got, I didn't have many points that year, but I got my first two assists or something. And I was so pumped after the game. And I forget, what was our, like, not Harry Neal, but our GM came in and all he did was go congratulate the guys that fought.
Oh,
I'm sitting there. I know him very well. And I
Glenn, hang on.
Glenn.
Oh, hang on. It's on the tip of my tongue.
I keep thinking of Goldup when I say Glenn, but it's not Glenn Goldup. It's Fred. His sister wrote for the Sun. It's Glenn Sonmore.
Okay. Glenn Sonmore. Yeah. That's it. He had the glass eye.
Yes, and I'm sitting there waiting. There's a young guy getting my first two assists in a win. He's shaking all the guys' hands that got into a fight, bypassed me. Oh, that doesn't matter. And who's the next guy that got into a fight? So, I mean, we were a pretty rugged team at that time. And, you know, Davy Keon was on that team too. And he was just shaking his head, you know, going, what did I leave the Leafs for?
So I remember talking to Mike Shakey Walton about him. I think it was Shakey I was talking to about this one. When he'd go to the bar with Glenn, whenever someone would leave the table, Glenn would pop out his glass eye and put it in his beer. And the guy would come back and there'd be an eyeball sitting in his beer.
Yeah.
It was a great
and when you get to the bottom of of your drink, you're looking. Somebody's looking straight at you.
Gabby, this is good. I don't know how we went down this track, but here we are. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today, well, one, it's always a good day to talk to you. But I remember this vividly. I remember, you know, you mentioned Hershey a second ago, and I remember you getting the job with the Washington Capitals, 2007, November 23rd. It's on this day. You coach your first game for the Caps, the 4-3 overtime win against the Flyers. And that was a really unique season because you guys had struggled before you got there. And then the whole season, it was like this story of the Capitals, you know, clawing themselves into the playoffs. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was like the last game of the season because I remember watching it in the Tampa airport. It was like a Sunday. You guys were playing the Florida Panthers. I think it was like a 3-1 win, and it got you into the playoffs. First of all, what do you remember from that, the first game coaching in the NHL, and just general memories of that season? I mean, it's Ovi, it's Green, it's so, you know, a lot of headline hockey players. But take us back to this day in 2007, Gabby.
First of all, it was the most memorable year of my hockey life, for sure. But I remember getting a call from Doug Yingst at about 6:15 in the morning and saying, listen, he's waking me up and says, what's wrong and everything. And he goes, nothing. He says, George McPhee is going to phone you in 5 minutes. Just be ready. And then he hung up. And George McPhee says, hey, you want to coach the Caps? And I said, are you kidding me? Like, I've been waiting my whole coaching life for this opportunity. I'm 53 years old at the time. And
wow.
I said automatically, and I'm pounding on my wife to wake her up. She's got to hear this, right? I mean, in a good way, like beating her up or anything. And he said, okay, I want you there for practice at 11 o'clock this morning. And I said, I'll be there. And so me and her just started jumping up and down on the bed like six-year-olds. Then we went into our six-year-old, and all three of us started jumping up on the bed. We couldn't believe what was going on. And I'd been, at that time, it was my third year with the Caps, and I'd been to the arena so many times, and I got lost going to the rink, and I was panicking so much. I was phoning John Walton. I was phoning everybody I knew. How do we get there? How do I get there? I didn't want to be late. And I got there. Everything worked out great. And I think to make this story a little shorter, is the best thing about game one in that 4-3 game against the Flyers, I changed everything up in one day. And I said, well, if I'm only going to be here a week, I may as well do what I want to do, right? And so remember saying I said, for today's power play, when we did the power play meeting, I said, I want you in the middle, okay? And then I want Mike Green to play the spot that Ovi plays. And Nick, you're going to now play the half wall on the power play, because he wasn't playing. He was a fourth line guy that made 7 minutes a night at that point. And I said, hey, you're the fourth overall pick. You're going to play. I'm going to play the hell out of you. And so I said, what's going to happen is everybody's going to converge on Ovi in the middle. At least two guys are going to converge. And I said, Nick, you've got the talent to pass that puck by Ovi to Mike. I want you to get the puck and put it in the top shelf. Well, lo and behold, the four-minute mark, they got a penalty, and that's exactly what happened. And I just turned around to the all the bench turned around to me at the same time. And I said, see, I told you. I know what I'm talking about. Just listen. And I think that got the instant respect from the guys right there. And I think that was the biggest moment to get the players to say, okay, I believe in this guy. That was the start of something that was really great. Then the last game you were talking about, we needed to win 12 out of our last 13 games, I told them. I said, we're allowed one loss if we want to catch these guys. And then we lost a game, and I said, we have to win the last seven. And we won the last seven. And even with that, we needed a little bit of help, as Carolina lost to Florida the night before, or two nights before. And that opened the door, because if they had won, we wouldn't have been able to catch Carolina. And that opened the door for us to win 3-1 or 3-2 or whatever the score was. And I just remember, again, like a little kid, jumping up and down and pounding on everybody's back and saying, we did it, we did it. And very exciting part of my hockey life.
You know, you mentioned Mike Green there a second ago, and that's someone who, you know, no longer plays in the NHL and had some glorious times with the Washington Capitals. I mean, now it's Carlson to Ovi, but before that, it was Green to Ovi for that one time on the power play. You coached him in Hershey. You coached him in Washington. I remember the first night I ever worked ringside for Hockey Night in Canada was a Washington Capitals Ottawa Senators game. This would have been 2007, December 29th, I believe. And I was doing a pregame, something with you, or maybe it was one of the intermissions, and you kept going on about Green, and we talked about his time in Hershey with you, etc. When you hear the name Mike Green, knowing how you coach him in a couple of places, what comes to your mind specifically, Gabby?
You know, a great skater. I kept thinking he was like a lesser version of Paul Coffey, because he could make all those rushes and still get back and play defense. And when I remember about Paul Coffey, you know, he would make all the rushes and he would still easily make it back to defend, you know, when he was with Edmonton. And that's what Green reminded me of. He wasn't as smooth as Paul, but he was just every bit as quick. And so, I mean, that's the first thing when you think about Mike Green's offensive talents. I mean, because he was so good offensively. I mean, he was the last defenseman to score 30 goals. I mean, and sometimes he would get in trouble. And like I always told him, I wanted him up with the play on every time he was out there. But when he would get in trouble, he would be leading the rush instead of being the fourth guy in the rush. And I'd have to take him aside and say, no, I don't want you leading the rush. Be the fourth guy. Like, he wanted to play forward half the time. But, you know, he scored so many clutch goals when I was coaching. And he was such he was just a fun-loving kid. And and that's what he was. He was a kid. And he exuberated fun. He looked at you in the eye and, yes, sir. And everything was, you know, but he wanted to have fun. And so you had to make things a little more fun than a little more serious when you were with Mike to get the best out of him.
You know, that was such an interesting team. I mean, listen, Ovechkin, you know, 65 goals. He gets, you know, the headlines, you know, the emerging star in Nick Backstrom. You mentioned Mike Green as well. You know, one of the players that I always looked at through his entire career, I can only imagine what it must have been like to coach him. Every time I would watch him practice, I would say, Victor Kozlov is amazing. Like, holy smokes, how is this guy not dominating this league? You know, the skill and the size and all of it. What was Kozlov like from a coach's point of view?
You know, he was very quiet, but he was very frustrating because just of the points you just finished mentioning, you'd think that this guy could get 40 a year, but he'd go into 25-game slumps and where he wouldn't score because he wouldn't shoot the puck. But then he'd all of a sudden start to say, you know, I'm going to shoot the puck for a while, and he'd get five goals in five games. I mean, and then he'd go back to, it's like, hey, I'm doing too well. They'll start to expect something from me if I do better, so I better slow down a little bit and not do as well. But one of the nicest men you ever wanted to meet, and very respectful. But I just think he didn't want the pressure of being too good. So, I mean, he would turn down his game, if that makes any sense. He didn't want to be the greatness like Ovi wanted to make. He just wanted to sort of hide amongst everybody, get 40 to 50 points, get them when you needed them, and be good. And that was him.
You know who was like that? I want to end on this one, too, and you'll know this player well. You know who was like that, too, who I always said, you know, if he would have applied himself more, he could have been one of the greats of his era, is Builder Lego, who was just, as you know, loaded with skill, but he always had the, you know what, if I score 40 goals this year, they're going to want me to do it again next year, and I don't want that pressure, and I don't want that stress. Let me end on this one for you. How good could Builder Lego have been, Bruce Boudreau?
He could have been so good. I was so jealous of him. Because I would sit on the bench and watch him. And, like, when he wanted to turn it on, his stick-handling ability was amazing, and his speed was deceptively amazing. But it was like, you know, I did it today. I did it, you know. I might do it again. But, I mean, he was so good. He could have been as good as any player going outside of Oilers, I think, at that point. But he was frustrating. But he was great when he wanted to be great.
I remember his old agent, Bill Waters, used to always, like, you know, go up to him and say, like, who's better, you or Bobby Smith? Who can score more goals? Who can skate better? Who can pass better? Like, well, how come this guy's lapping you in salary? How come this guy's like, you're better than this player? And there's no one better than you. Gabby, it's always a pleasure catching up. This has been a lot. Like, we went down that WHA detour as well with with Glenn Sonmore and Bill Butters' stories. I didn't expect that one when I woke up this morning, but hockey's a wonderful place, Gabby. Hockey's a wonderful place.
We could talk about that stuff for hours, I'm sure. But always great talking to you, Jeff. And hopefully I'll get a chance to do it pretty soon.
We hope so as well. Thanks thanks again. Bruce Boudreau, Gabby, ladies and gentlemen, joining us here on the program, NHL coach, and now with the NHL Network. We'll step away. Leah Hextall, play-by-play voice of Rogers Hometown Hockey, last night handling the Winnipeg-Pittsburgh game. We'll talk to Leah in a moment when the Merrick Show continues.
Zero shots on that power play for the Penguins. There's a shot right there. Rebound in front. There's another shot. They score! Jason Zucker with the goal has tied this game at one.
Welcome back to the program. That is Leah Hextall calling the game last night. The Winnipeg Jets and the Pittsburgh Penguins in Rogers' hometown. She joins me now. Hex, how are you?
I'm all right, Merrick. How are you, sir?
I'm good. True or false, the only thing you regret about last night was not getting able to roast me and Elliot because you didn't get handed a promo for 32 Thoughts podcast. True or false?
True story. And here's the thing about that. So, you know, like any good broadcaster, you get, you know, a bunch of promos that you're going to need to maybe go to during the game. So, you know, I do my due diligence and I read them all before to make sure I know. And here I get to the bottom of the sheet. I want to reference that, the bottom, the very last promo. Most promos are about two lines. You know, this is a paragraph. So I feel like you and Elliot must have wrote it yourself. And then it says, for the most insightful, intelligent, in-depth hockey talk. Joined Jeff Merrick and Elliot Freeman. And I honestly, Merrick, I was like, okay, you know, play-by-play is still tough for me because I'm learning, but that, reading that promo and selling it, more importantly, that those two are the most insightful and in-depth and intelligent, that's going to take everything I have as a broadcaster. So, but I didn't get to it, so it was very sad.
So if they allowed you then to freestyle the promo, what would have what would it have sounded like, Hex?
If you want to listen to two buffoons just talk about hockey, join Merrick and Friedman.
Two guys
because
love
that's
the,
what you're gonna love get.
Love the sounds of their own voices. Check out these two billy goats on a semi-regular basis.
You know what I have to say? All jokes aside, it's one of my favorite podcasts, that and Smartless. I give you guys full credit. I listen to it every week and, you know, twice a week sometimes. And, you know, and you guys do a great job. I love it.
Enough. I'd rather talk about Smartless. He's like, I talk to like Elliot more than I talk to my wife. He's like he's my work spouse. Okay.
You guys are so an old married couple. You guys are getting there. You can hear it. The little fits and the fights, and it's great.
I know he loves me by the way he ignores me. that's what I always say to myself. Because if you can hear him like making sandwiches in the background when he's talking to me, or making coffee or something, or usually texting. Okay, so last night's game. So here's what I'm curious about. So you're doing the Winnipeg Jets and the Pittsburgh Penguins, and the Hextall name is synonymous with hockey and has been in hockey for decades, including right now with yourself and your cousin Ron, who's a GM of the Pittsburgh Penguins. How much would you try to cozy up to your cousin, maybe in the morning skate, try to get a little bit of juice from cousin Ron before the game? How does that dynamic work?
Well, it's kind of interesting, Jeff, because I really felt, you know, listen, as a society, we're in a global pandemic. It's been, you know, almost 2 years now. Haven't had a chance to see him. I thought, oh, he's going to be just delighted to see his flower girl, you know, at morning skate. You know, it's going to be a great family reunion. So the two of them are sitting there, and by the two of them, I mean Berkey's sitting there with him, Brian Burke. So, you know, I don't just get Ron, I get to deal with Brian. But so, you know, I had reached out to Ron before and said, listen, I'm doing the game, a little bit of short notice on it. So if you don't mind, could we chat and you could kind of catch me up on what's going on? So I get there and he tells me about a few players. And then I say, you know, Tristan Jarry. I mean, he mentioned you called him over the summer. You had a few conversations. I said, what did you guys chat about? Which, you know, gave him this confidence. And he just looks at me stone faced, like, you know, basically like, how dare you ask me that, basically. And he just said to me, I don't share conversations I have with players, Leah. And I was like, okay, you know, but that's Ron to a nutshell. I mean, like, he is the most locked down guy. Elliot would tell you this. You know, he's not going to give you stuff that he doesn't want to give you. And he just believes that if it's in the team, it's in the team, and that's who he is. And people always say, like, shouldn't you get scoops on that? I'm like, I am the last person he's going to tell. Like, he puts media bands on me at family functions. Like, when we were celebrating the Cup in 2012 when he won with L.A., I wasn't allowed to bring my phone in. He grabbed it from me when I walked into the party. I was like, are you kidding me? Oh, yeah. You can't get confiscated. He said, you'll get it back at the end of it.
Oh, that's awesome. What did you make of the game last night? Like, Pittsburgh's a fascinating team. Like, they go in, just, like, romp through, you know, Ottawa, Toronto, Winnipeg, only surrender one goal in the process, and all of a sudden, maybe people that were concerned about Pittsburgh a week ago aren't concerned about Pittsburgh this week. Your thoughts?
The biggest thing, Merrick, is that they're healthy. You know, they only have 71 in Malkin out of the lineup as he still recovers from knee surgery. And, you know, ever since the Buffalo game, which would have been 4 games ago, which they only lost 2-1, you know, they've been healthy and they've started to come. And I just think that they're continuing to just basically get used to having all their regulars in the roster. I said it last night on the game. You know, Ron told me, he goes, we had $31 million out of our roster. That is, when you think about it in that way, and the dollars and cents and the price of players that were out, that's huge, right? So I just think the biggest thing is health. And the fact is, what I noticed a lot last night, Merrick, is that at the beginning of the game against the Jets, Pittsburgh was really, you know, kind of just lifting it up from their own end, you know, not just dumping it in, like, I mean, lifting it in the air and putting it in and giving chase. It didn't work for them in that first period. And when I saw them come out in the second, they were not doing that anymore. Now they were getting that beautiful long lead pass from Chris Letang or Dumoulin in the back end and sending it up ice and carrying the puck in. And just to see them be able to have that change, and that obviously comes from coaching and what's being noticed, I just think Mike Sullivan has this team all pulling in the same direction. And that's what's made Pittsburgh successful throughout the years.
Yeah, you know, they, and this is, I mean, this has really been a story for Pittsburgh for a long time. Like, if they, it's the one team that is super highly skilled, like, even when, specifically when everyone's healthy, Malkin, Crosby, Letang, et cetera. Like, it's loaded with, like, elite level superstars. But if they take their foot off the gas at all, they fall apart. Like, I've always felt this way about the Penguins. And now that, you know, you mentioned no Malkin, you know, Sid has had the hospital bracelet on and then it was, you know, now it's off. And he's playing. We know some guys are still, you know, nicked up and bandaged up a little bit. But it seems to me as if it's still, if it's a team that takes his foot off the gas even a little bit, it tends to crumble. But Mike Sullivan has these guys, like, literally, Hex, just outworking teams. Like, yep. there's no secret here. There's no, like, oh, like, hidden form, like, oh, drop down defenseman as teams try to exit and the wingers regroup. Like, that's how they won those two most recent Stanley Cups. And we'd see it time and time again. But there's no secret system here. This is just the outworking teams, right?
Absolutely. And I think we have to remember that, yes, do they still have these big names? They do, but these are aging superstars. And it's not to take away from the likes of Crosby and Malkin and even Jeff Carter, who they've brought in. I mean, these guys still all have so much game left in them. But last night, what I really noticed is, you know, Danton Heinen on the fourth line. Evan Rodriguez, who's been just a Swiss Army knife for them, getting it done, being able to, you know, play up during the injuries. He was the second line center. There's a reason he's second in goals right now on Pitt, and that's because he was able to play behind Carter when Crosby was injured and no Malkin. So for me, it's, you know, you have the superstars still on your roster, but to your point, Jeff, they just are all pulling in the same direction, outworking teams, and that's what they did last night against the Jets. Once they got that lead, they couldn't even get through the neutral zone into Pittsburgh's end. It was unbelievable how they just checked them right to the end. And that was it. And that was a perfect road game by Pittsburgh to get it done and run through Canada 3-0.
Yeah. Hex, before I let you go, we got about maybe 45 seconds for this one. Probably not enough, but I know you can do it because you're a pro. How do you see Crosby right now? Like, the points aren't there. But how do you see, I know he's coming off the injury and the wrist starting to get better, but how do you see Crosby right now?
I look at Crosby that the Pittsburgh Penguins can't be the Pittsburgh Penguins with that work ethic without him, because he's the leader. Hmm. He's not just doing it on the ice. And I know that people might look to his points, but last night, even with him recovering still from that wrist surgery, all those important draws late in the game, who's in the circle? It's 87. He is Crosby. Still the guy. He is still the guy. He is going to continue to lead not only on the ice, but off the ice. And, you know, just even in warm-up, he's the last guy right to the end. And the guys are hanging out there with him. He sets the tone for this team. And if he's not there, I don't know the identity of the Pittsburgh Penguins.
He sets the work rate. You're 100% right on that one. He completely sets the work rates. We're up against the clock. Got to finish off the show. Want to mention as well, you're doing the Nashville-New Jersey game on Friday on ESPN. Look forward to that. And I am, Hex, very much looking forward to finally reading a 32 Thoughts promo on television just to see the Hextall accents you put on it, if you know what I mean.
I can't wait. I can't wait for that moment. I'm looking forward to it.
Feel free to roast. We'll love it. You be well. You're one of my favorites. You know, that goes back a long time. Thanks so much for doing this, Hex. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
There she is, Leah Hextall from ESPN and the NHL on Sportsnet, handling the Penguins Jets last night. I want to thank Bruce Boudreau as well for stopping by. That was a lot of fun. WHA Detour. Eric Engels from Sportsnet breaking down the Montreal situation. Haley Salavian doing same for the Calgary Flames. And Elliot Friedman, who kicked it off, talking about the Avs, who won 5 in a row, and Nazem Kadri's hot. Back tomorrow with more Merrick Show. Thanks for joining me today.